Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Craig, it is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic, and I couldn't be more excited today because I've got somebody on the channel today who has been one of my favorite magicians since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. This person is a legend in the magic community, and I do not say that word lightly, a genuine legend. He's been there, done that. He's a performer, he's a creator, he's an innovator, and he's a huge presence in the UK magic community. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Mr. Mark Leveridge. How are you doing, Mark?
Hello, Craig. I'm very well. Thank you very much.
I am so excited about this interview because, you know, I have been the biggest fan of your work and everything that you've done at Mark Leveridge Magic. Half of my acts in the early days and even now came from the stuff that I bought from you and your videotapes and everything. So thank you for doing this. I really
not at all. In fact, actually, you say that, I can remember being at sort of conventions like the IBM convention behind my dealer stand, and you would pop up and you'd talk to me and look at a few things and buy one or two things. You'd go away. Next thing I know, you're back again. What about this one? And what does that do? And yeah, you're right. You were always there.
Well, I think even now to this point, I could probably dem right now every single one of your master routines, like immediately.
Amazing. I wish I could.
and most of the stuff from Forever Flapping, and I'm Still Flapping, and all of this, that, like, so much amazing material, which we will definitely get into. But what's really nice, and we talked about Mark Leveridge Magic, and we'll talk about how that all came to be in a bit, but one of the reasons I gravitated towards you as a creator is because you've always being a performer as well. You've always had that side of your business where you're going out and gigging and you're doing shows, and that's as important a part of what you do as the creating. And you see a lot of people who create magic and magic dealers, and that's all they do, but you have real world experience. You're out doing shows and booking gigs. So you've been there, done that, and you've bought the t-shirt, you know, so you come into it from a very different sort of...
Yeah, it's funny that you're quite right, because a lot of people are very creative. I think way more creative than me in terms of their output and that sort of thing. And some of the ideas that the guys these days come up with, I'm gobsmacked by. They are so clever, so visual, quick and visual. But for me, I'm a commercial performer. I always have been. I like entertaining lay people. I'm not really a magician's magician. My magic, I think, is nice for lay people, but it's not always a magician fooler necessarily. But that's not important to me. What's important to me is getting out there and seeing lay people and showing them what I think is nice tricks and having fun. And so that's always been the emphasis. I think to myself when I want a trick, what would I like to show my audiences? Oh, wouldn't it be good if? And then I will devise a trick or a routine, and then I go out and I trial it. Oh, that didn't work. Oh, this works really well. And a lot of the, especially for the first, I don't know, decade or so, everything was coming out of my act directly. Obviously, you can't have 100 tricks in your act. So over the years, it changed. But I always used everything at some point, even if it wasn't in my current act, to make sure that it worked and that it was as best as I could get it. So, and I do love performing, and I shall continue to perform as long as I'm able.
Oh, and you can tell. What I want to do is, before we talk about you as a performer and you as a creator, I just want to, because I don't even know the answer to this question, I'd like to talk very briefly about your origin story and how you got into magic. Was it your quintessential, I met somebody who pulled a coin from behind my ear, or was there, how did little Mark Leveridge get into magic?
It was a little bit like that. A sixth birthday party, my mum and dad booked a magician called Mr. Coombs, who was the local magician in the little village in Kent where we lived. And he was quite a scary man with a huge bushy beard, and he chain smoked, so he always stank of nicotine. And he was in the village, people went, ooh. But he loved entertaining. He was a good entertainer. And my mum and dad booked him because they knew that he would do a good show. And I said to my mum and dad after, I said, I like that man and those things he does. I was about six, as I say, at the time. And I said, I can do that, you know? They said, can you? I said, yes. Of course, I couldn't. So then they took pity on me. And my mum and dad obviously had discussed it, and they managed to find a magic set, which again was for the following Christmas. And then they used to go to Smith's and order magic books, which they didn't realise were fantastic books. Some of the Bruce Elliott, sort of classic Bruce Elliott tomes. Of course, we're talking sort of early 60s here. So there's no internet, you know, there's no easy access to magic. In fact, where I lived in Southeast Kent, there weren't really any even other magicians that I knew of. They tried to find another magician, they couldn't find one. Whereas these days, it'd be so easy. You just go online and type in magician Southeast Kent, you'd get a whole load of them, wouldn't you? So it was very much something that I was all on my own with. And in a way, that's why, because I didn't have any money as a kid, I used to try and invent magic tricks. And that's where the invention started. I thought, I want more tricks, but I can't buy them. I used to go to the library and get books. And I can remember writing out, I had scan on card tricks. And I can remember two or three tricks that I liked so much, I actually copied them out longhand. I wrote them out because that's in the library book back. And I wanted to remember the tricks. So I actually wrote them down. It's ridiculous. And that was how the inventing started as well. I want a different type of trick. And I reinvented the wheel. Do you know, I actually invented, I thought, the vanishing wand, you know, the paper wand. You put it in a bag and then you crush it up. I thought I invented that because I thought that's a way you could make a wand disappear. And it was things like that, you know, that and all throughout my early time, sort of between 6 and 10 or 11, that's what I was doing until eventually I started doing kid shows when I was about, I did my first kid show when I was 11. And the kids were eight years of age. And I said to my mum, what tricks shall I do? She said, well, I like card tricks. So she said, why don't you do that nice spelling card trick that you do? So I had a nightmare, put it in my act, complete disaster, of course. Not only that, but one kid who came up to help me with a sponge ball routine, he knocked my table over and I had all my props balanced precariously on this table, and he knocked it over and it smashed to the floor and shot my props all over the floor. And my dad, who'd obviously been the chauffeur to take me to the gig, was standing in the back of the village hall, and he went like that and turned around and walked out. He couldn't take the strain of seeing me scurrying around on the floor trying to pick this table up. Oh, it was absolutely terrible. So I don't know how I continued after that horrible experience, but I did. And all throughout my teenage years, I was doing a lot of kid shows, and then gradually I started to do close-up as I got to sort of 17, 18, and eventually used it to fund my way through university and things like that. So it was, I suppose, a fairly standard way to start.
Well, it's very interesting. One thing that's always I've noticed about the magic that I see you do is, and especially with the creations that you make, you're not just focused on close-up, but you've always had some amazing ideas with kid shows as well. And you see a lot of close-up magicians, especially ones that are as talented as you, they almost look down on kids entertainers. But I mean, you don't at all. One of my favorite tricks that I still do in my kid show today is one that I bought off you, and it's the wand with the silks that drop down off that. Yeah. I love that trick. I do it.
Silk release wand, yeah.
Yeah, I love that trick. And you've always had that element of servicing kids entertainers whilst at the same time creating amazing close-up magic as well.
Well, that was actually a problem for me initially, because magicians got to know me just as a close-up magician. And when I turned pro in 81, it was on the back of winning the IBM close-up competition. I'm going to have a quick drink. Hold on.
That's okay.
And so I started off doing lectures that were all close-up, selling close-up tricks. But actually, most of the shows I was doing was for kid shows. So I thought, how do I stop people seeing me just as a close-up magician and understand that actually I've got loads of ideas for kid show. And I did struggle initially. People, Mark's doing, no, he's a close-up magician. And it did take a while. And I think it was the Magic Party book, when that came out, Games of Magic, that started to change people's view, because it was quite a lot of material in that book. And it was games and it was magic and it was principles of entertaining children. And I think that changed a lot of people's perception. And from that point onwards, I was then able to release individual kids' tricks as well as my close-up. Close-up was always the main thrust, but I had, a small but quite nice range of children's things as well.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I want to ask you, you mentioned that you went to university and that you turned pro in 81. So was there a period of time from finishing university before you went pro where you kind of got a normal job? The reason I ask this is because one question I get on my channel all the time is, I'm a semi-pro and I'm a hobbyist. I want to turn professional. When's the right time to do that? When's the wrong time to do that? Like, you mentioned that you won the IBM, which is fantastic. Was that the catalyst, or were you thinking about it beforehand? How did that whole journey from finishing university to turning professional kind of look for you?
Well, I finished university in 78, did a teacher training, 1 year PGCE in 79. Yeah, and then I got a job as a teacher, secondary school teacher. And so I was still doing a lot of magic. And I didn't want the kids that I was teaching to know I was a magician. Mm. I thought, if I tell them, they're going to say, no, never mind teaching us German. Show us another trick. Mm. So I kept it a big secret. And I liked teaching. It was a natural fit. I think people often say about, because teaching is like being a performer only 5 days a week, all day. Basically, that's what you're doing. You're not entertaining the kids, but you are presenting and performing for them in one way or another. So it's a natural fit for an entertainer. But I was doing a lot of magic, I could feel myself. And my wife said to me, she said, you know, Mark, you're not doing this right. Oh, I always sit up and take notice when she says things like that. What do you mean? She said, well, if you want to be a teacher, you're not putting the hours in. She said, you're actually leaving as soon as the bell goes at the end of school. You're racing home. You're piling a load of stuff in your car. You're driving to Leicester and you're doing a lecture. You're getting back at 2 a.m. You're then trying to have your books marked and your lesson prepared for the next day to face the kids again. You can't do this long term. You're going to be a teacher and go into it wholeheartedly. Or if you want to do magic, that's fine. You know, I'll support you, but you need to make a decision. And it's the sort of thing
in the world. I just need to put that in right there. You've got
absolutely. I would tell anybody, my wife is just the best. And it was the thing where she said, and I will support you, whatever decision you make. Well, we were in our 20s at the time. We didn't have any children at that point, but that was quite a thing for her to say. And she really meant it, but she just wanted me to make up my mind. So I said, I'll think about it. And about 30 seconds later, right, I thought about it. And like the way men do, you know, very focused. I said, I really would love to do magic. Now, I was already doing lectures. I was selling a few things at lectures, but I didn't have a separate dealership at that point. Mm-hmm. But I'd had at least 2, if not 3 lectures full of close-up already by then, in that sort of 3-year period. I was very profligate at that point. So, and then it just so happened. Then I went in for the close-up in 81, the IBM convention, and I fortunately won it. And I got a lot of local publicity, as you do. You know, I was on TV and radio and in the press and everything. And I said to Roz, I said, because I then planned to leave the following summer at the end of the school academic year. I said, I really want to take advantage of this now. While I'm in the public eye, I want to be able to push this, but I can't because I'm still teaching. And at the time, schools were trying to shed language teachers. So I went to the head of the school I was working at and he went, oh, yes, by all means, leave at the beginning of December when you want to, because I want to do kid shows all December. And he was happy to get rid of me because they were trying to get rid of languages. It goes in cycles. Sometimes they come back and you're the flavour of the month again, and then other times you're not. So in that sense, I was fortunate. So I left in first of December 1981. I became a full-time magician and have been so ever since, lucky old me. Oh, and by the way, just to say, my wife has always supported me through good times and not so good times. And Craig, as a pro, you'll know what that's like. It's like this. Mm-hmm. One minute, everybody loves you. Money's flowing in. The next minute, as my internet or phone being cut off, you know, it's never predictable, but it's always fun.
That's amazing. And one thing that I've noticed about you, Mark, is you've always taken the business of magic very seriously, away from the dealership. As a performer, I've seen you talk on your podcast about the business and the marketing of magic and how important the business side of things is. Fairly sure I either heard you say, or you said it to me, or I read it somewhere, that you were in the entrepreneur circle at one point. And you do come across as very entrepreneurial. Like a lot of the conventions that you've planned, which we'll get to in a bit, and a lot of the different, you it's almost like you've spotted gaps in the market and you've kind of tried to jump in there before anyone else. I remember when you were doing like the dealer days where you got everyone into a room and then, you know, the British Magic Symposiums. And then later on, you were one of the first people to move specifically to online. And you always seem to be two steps ahead of everyone else. And that comes from understanding the importance of business and taking opportunities. Would you agree? And is that something that you focused on right from the very beginning?
Absolutely. I've always been interested in the mechanics of business, of marketing. I've got no training in it, but I think you learn sometimes better when you're very specific about what it is you're trying to achieve. Set a goal. How am I going to get there? How am I going to make people notice this, that, or the other? What will be the best way? What can I do that nobody else is doing? How can I do what nobody else is doing? How can I create something that is relatively unique, not totally unique usually, because that's very difficult because most things have been done at some point. But you're right. I was in the entrepreneur circle for 5 years. Nigel Bottrell's business help. It's a sort of a club, but it's not. It's a business help thing. I don't know how you really, he's still doing it, I believe. Was excellent. It gave me a boost at a time in my career when I needed it. I just about turned 50 at that point, and I'd been in magic quite a while, and I was starting to stagnate. I didn't realize it until I went and he opened my eyes to all the possibilities in terms of marketing, and I got so excited, all these things that I could suddenly try, which I'd never thought of. Because I didn't have any official training, I didn't know what I was missing almost. And he pointed it out to me and all the many hundreds of other people that he deals with. And he was a total inspiration. I've got a lot of time for him. I think he's one of the best speakers I've ever seen. Mm. He could talk about doing toast and how to cook a piece and make it so interesting. And you want to go and immediately cook toast. He's that kind of person. He could sell coals to Newcastle. So it was very, very important 5 years. And it gave me a push and it sent me off in a slightly different direction than the one I was getting into a rut of doing the same thing I'd always done because it had worked reasonably well. And this suddenly shot me off in all sorts of different directions and made me think differently. So I'm very grateful to him for that. And it was just interesting. Mm. I think business is interesting. It's not easy, as you all know. It's not a straight line. It's not like that, is it? You know, you don't just start and you just exponentially grow. It doesn't work like that. You make mistakes. But being self-employed, I've always loved being self-employed because if I want to do something, I think it through. I don't have to talk to anybody. I don't have to clear it with anybody. I will talk to my very close friends often about ideas just to make sure I'm not being a complete idiot with it. But usually by then I've sorted out in my own mind, yes, I think I can do this. And then I can just do it. And sometimes I've had ideas and within one day, I've turned it into reality. It was just a concept, particularly with events, sort of mini conventions and things like that. I've turned it around and I've started to do the publicity and the thing is almost then has a momentum of its own. And I love that power, if you like, that you can have of being able to to do things like that. And that I find exciting. It's kept me interested and it's kept me wanting to carry on doing it as long as possible.
And it's probably one of the reasons you've been so successful, because, you know, there's a lot of magicians out there that, and they still have this attitude, oh, I'm going to wait for the phone to ring. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to hopefully get in with an agent and they're going to do everything for me. But when you're self-employed, you have to be the guy that's doing the marketing, the customer care, the customer service, the customer journey, the ads, the social media. You have to be the person that's doing everything. And really, if you want to be successful, you have to learn how to do that stuff. And you are right, Nigel. Nigel's a great place to go because he's, you know, I know Nigel, so I know, you know, he is very
motivated. He's very dynamic. I did an interview once with Ian Moran in Manchester.
Oh, yeah.
And I asked him, I said, you're a full-time pro, Ian. What do you do in the day? You know, I mean, I know what the answer to that was, but I was just in an interview. So I asked him, what do you do in the day? Do you just, you know, read the newspaper and drink a cup of coffee, put your feet up? And of course he laughed and goes, no, he said, I work harder in the day when I'm not performing than I do at night when I'm out performing. He said, because I systematically spend time marketing myself. And I think this is the mistake that perhaps some people make. They think they're a semi-pro and they flirt or think that they might like to turn pro. And they think to themselves, wow, if I had more time, I could do more shows. If I did more shows at the rate that I earn, I'll be really well off and I won't have to work very hard. No, you'll work harder than you've ever worked. And it's not if you do it right. And it's nothing to do with the shows. The shows, you can not coast with them, but if you've got those nailed, that's not the difficult bit. It's the marketing. Like you've just said, getting your name out there, doing all the things that you need to do and doing them consistently, even when they don't always work. You know, you can try so many different types of marketing these days. We're very lucky. We've got so many choices, particularly online, to make. But that in itself can be a problem, can't it? Because you don't know which one to do. I can't afford to do all of these. I haven't got the time to do all of these. Which are best for me? And it's making those types of decisions, I think, that decide whether a business is going to fail, whether it's going to succeed, not whether you're a good performer or not.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's one thing I've admired about you so much. Outside of the performing, because obviously, you know, like you said, there's been ups and downs, but you've always had a very successful career. You said that when you turned pro, you were doing lectures and you'd been creating stuff to sell at a lecture. What made you decide to go down the route of doing a magic dealership? And what made you decide to go down the route of, because most magic dealers, when you see a magic dealer, they wholesale in a whole bunch of stuff. And they might have a small selection of their own range, but, you know, they'll contact their Murphys, they'll contact their Magics, whatever it may be, and they'll all sell everything else. But one thing that Mark Leverage Magic did right from the very beginning is all of the items that you sold were exclusive to you. The only place you could get them is from you, which was one of the reasons I loved you so much. Because I knew that you'd always have something new and exciting and nobody else would have it, and it'd be great. So I suppose, what made you decide to open up a dealership and go down that route? And was it hard splitting your time between being a performer and a busy performer at that and running a separate business, creating and producing all of this stuff?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was hard splitting it, because it almost defined itself in terms of time allocation. I suppose the reason I started selling things was because I did the lecture, and I can remember, it's funny, when you're young, you try things, right? And in those days, you were talking early 80s now, early to mid 80s, when I was really getting going. And in those days, dealing was not as sophisticated as it is now. It's so sophisticated now, relatively speaking. And so I can remember putting together little packet tricks, seeing is believing, where the little four cards print themselves, from blank cards print themselves. And that was one of the items in my first lecture, the lowdown on close-up. And I took the cards, I literally typed on my mum's typewriter the instructions with carbon to make several copies, folded it up and put it in a brown envelope, sealed the envelope and wrote seeing is believing on it. And I went to the Zodiac, the first sort of outside my own club, the first lecture I did was for the Zodiac Magic Society in London. And I had about half a dozen items, and they were all in brown envelopes with names on. And when I look back at it now, I don't know what they must have thought. But what happened was, as I was doing these lectures, people were buying them a few things on the night, which was great. But then one or two people who either seen something and then they didn't buy it on the night, wanted to buy it afterwards, or they'd heard, and they weren't there. And someone said, oh, you should get this from Mark. So this is good. Started to contact me and say, you couldn't send me that. I meant to pick it up on the night, but I didn't get, could you send it to me? And so I accidentally started a mail order business, which involved packaging, labels, going to the post, all the various things that you need to run a mail order business. And then I thought, so I did just sales of lecture items. But then when I turned pro, and sort of shortly after that, I thought, I need more than this. I can't just sell. I'm not going to be doing lectures, although I've always done a lot of lectures. I'm not going to do enough to make a business out of. I need to sell things separately. So then I started to bring out tricks that were not in lectures, but were sold as mail order or over a stand at a convention, obviously. And I only wanted to sell my own ideas because I wanted to be different. I didn't want to be like everybody else. And at the time, people like Stephen Tucker, for instance, he was a contemporary of mine. He was doing the same thing, selling basically his own ideas. And dealers in those days weren't quite as big, with the exception of Supreme and one or two others. A lot of dealers were small, you know, Roy Roth selling his wallets. A lot of dealers were very small and very niche and very individual in a way that they're not now. The internet has spawned a lot of, as Donald Bevan used to call them, what's he called them? Magic retailers. Mm. Not dealers, they're retailers. They're basically getting, like you said, getting stuff in from Murphy's and MacMagic and selling it on, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that. You need that. But I decided to be a magic dealer who basically invents and markets his own stuff. And what I did try for a very short period, I don't know whether you remember this, Craig, I brought out one or two tricks which I really liked of other people's. I didn't do it. I did it for about a year. And I tried to incorporate them into, and the trouble was, as soon as I got the idea, I could think of all sorts of ways to, as I saw it, improve it. And I thought, well, I can't improve it because I have to sell it as the instruction show. I can't den it or perform it one way and then sell it. Well, this isn't what I saw. Mm. And I found that very difficult to perform something that I didn't completely 100% believe in. Mm. So in the end, I knocked it on the head. I said, this is no good. I can't morally sell this like this. I'm going to go back to just selling my own ideas. So that was that brief flirtation with somebody else's products. I don't want to sound, I'm not trying to be arrogant here and say, oh, I'm so much better. No, I'm not. It's just that I wanted to be able to demo it and honestly be able to talk to people about it over a stand and say, look, this is great for this, it'll do that. I know everything about this trick, know it inside and outside, know how you should perform it to get the most out of it. And with somebody else's, because I hadn't devised it, and I could think of perhaps other ways I would change it, but I was actually going to really perform it. It just didn't fit. So that's why I've always stuck with it. And it stood me in good stead. I've never been a big dealer. I've never been a Vanishing Ink or something like that, who I have a lot of time for, incidentally. I think they've managed to combine being a big business with a personal face with Josh and Andy. And they do it, that's, I think, very well. Yeah. One of the best modern dealers out there, I think, the way they do things. Nobody's perfect, but they get pretty close sometimes. So, yeah, so that's why I went down that route.
And I have to ask this question because I said at the beginning of the interview, I perform so much of your tricks. Like I was looking through my drawers before this interview and I was like, looking at all the different things that I do, you know, I've got your perfect crime. I still do that now. We were talking about the ring box. I have so many different routines that I do. I have to ask, as somebody who's created so much magic over the last couple of decades, do you have any advice on creativity? Because a lot of people that come into magic, especially new people, they have a burning desire to create magic, whether it be to put in their own show or, you know, they want to become a creator and, you know, they want to start actually making a name for themselves as, you know, the next Jay Sankey or whatever. How do you approach creativity? Because I find that a lot of people, they just take a deck of cards, put it down in front of them, and then they just go, nope. And they can't find it. It's like, I don't know what I'm going to do here. Your range has always been so eclectic. Like, that's one of the things that struck me. It's like, right, you're going to bring out this coin box routine. Now we're going to do this rope routine. Now we've got this card trick. Now we've got this mentalism routine. Now we've got this kid show thing. Now we've got this intricate thing made out of brass. And it's always, you know, and then we've got dice and then this and that. It's almost like you never know what Mark's going to come up with, because you don't just stick to one prop or one genre. You just, you run the gauntlet.
Yeah, I get bored by the thought of only, I couldn't be like people like Paul Gordon and only do card magic. He loves it. You know, it's him through and through. And I really like Paul. And he's one of these people who just is so enthusiastic about his magic. He's a delight to spend time with. But that's not, I couldn't do that. I'd get bored just doing card tricks. So I wrote a book years ago, which I still sell as an ebook, The Simple Guide to Creativity, in which I literally, the title tells you everything you need to know. It's a simple guide to it, because I think trying to be creative can get quite complex. There are some good books out there, but they, you read them and you get to the end of them if you can get through them in the first place, because they're so dense, if you see what I mean, so much information. And you get to the end, you think, sorry, so what do I do? And actually, being creative is as much about thinking freely, having an imagination. These days, certainly, I didn't always do it like this, but these days I literally think of a plot. Wouldn't it be good if I'd like to be able to do this? Now, how can I do it? Now, I can do that because obviously, having been in magic a long time, I know a lot of principles. I know lots of methods. So usually if I come up with a plot or an idea for a trick, I can almost immediately start to visualize how I might achieve it. It may not be how I end up doing it in the end, but it gives me a starting point. Yeah. But that starting point only happens if I can think of the plot in the first place. And so I think if you've got a good amount of magic knowledge, that is a good way to start. That certainly is my preferred way these days. What do I want to do? Now let's solve it. It's like a puzzle to be solved. But if you don't have a lot of extensive knowledge, it gets much more difficult, I think. Because if you can't visualize even how something might be achieved, you will either reinvent the wheel like I did when I was a child and waste a lot of time like that. Or you, like you've just said, you sit there and you go, no idea. Mm-hmm. And people say, oh, well, I'm not creative. Well, you might be. You just haven't perhaps approached it in quite the right way. Now, right from when I first started devising tricks, right when I was a teenager, I mean, my leverage envelope, which I'm known for envelopes, as you know, Craig, and I invented my leverage envelope when I was 15. And I was sitting in my bedroom at home, and I had this concept in my head of how you can make an envelope that would make things produce and disappear, an ordinary letter envelope. And I still to this day can remember, I said to my mum, I think I've got any envelopes. And she gave me this big batch of envelopes. I then proceeded to cut them up in all sorts of different ways. I had bits of envelope all over my table in my bedroom, all over the floor. I was like, no, that's not it. No, that's not quite right. And eventually I hit on this idea, and I still use it today for this envelope. Now, that's a slightly different approach, because here it was almost trial and error. I didn't have something I could go to, because I didn't know about gimmicked envelopes or how anything might work. I was starting literally from nowhere and just experimenting, just cutting stuff up and thinking, what would it look like? What does it need to do? And so almost an intellectual exercise immediately followed up by a practical experimentation. So that's another way to do it, is to just play. Magic's playing, isn't it? You know, you pick up a deck of cards and fiddle with it. Sometimes something happens, or you fiddle with a coin. Oh, that looked good. What did I do then? Somebody shows you a move.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, I love that move. What can I do with it? I did in the early days, that was when I first met Chris Payne, who I met at university. And he was the best thing that ever happened to me in my magic life, because he was way ahead of me. He'd won the IBM Close-Up. He'd won the Magic Circle Young Magician of the Year. He was mentored by people like Roy Johnson and people like that. He was a really big noise at the time as a very, very young man. And he knew loads of principles that I'd never come across. And he showed them all to me in this great deluge of method. And then being creative, I mean, I've got so many things I could do. And I didn't know, no wonder I got a 2.2 at university. I was too busy doing magic. I didn't have enough time for study. I can remember I invented a trick called the unprint button,
which is
one of my early sales items. And I invented that in my university bedroom at 3 a.m. I'd spend about 2 hours trying to work out the handling with Elmsley counts and God knows what else. And eventually it clicked at about 3 a.m, which you kind of think you do when you're a student. You're not answerable to anybody very much, so you can do it. So if I hadn't met him and he hadn't shown me all that stuff, I probably wouldn't have been able to get such a kickstart to my creative career. So I'm very grateful to him for that. But it's just, I love the creative process. That is the most exciting thing, to start with an idea, and then it might go through lots of different versions and ways and methods. And then you end up saying, God, you know, I tell you what, that is really good. And that pleasure. And then if you can then sell it and other people get to use it as well and they like it too, that is just, for me, is the most satisfying. I love it when you say things like, oh, after all these years, you're still using some of my tricks. I'm so happy about that, that a pro like you will still use one or two of the tricks. I think that's fabulous. And I'm really pleased to hear that. So that's very satisfying.
Amazing. And I do, because a lot of your stuff, it comes back to the fact that it's very commercial, it's practical, and it's a real world worker. Not that I've got anything against the stuff that comes out these days that's designed specifically for one camera angle on TikTok, but I'm a worker, and your stuff is designed to be done for real people. And that's what I love about it. Talking about Chris Payne, one thing I want to bring up, and I think I might be wrong, in which case I apologize, but I'm pretty sure it was you and Chris that were running the British Magic Symposiums. And they were incredible. For new people that are into magic, that are watching this, you came into magic at just the wrong time, because a decade or so ago, you and Chris were running what I still think today is the best conventions. You had people like Tommy Wonder on the bill. I mean, how did that come about with you and Chris, and why did you stop them? You did like 7, right? 7.
We did 9.
9. And by the way, I've got the hardbound book. I don't know if that's still available as an ebook or something. If it is, people need to get it because it's amazing. But 9 British Magical Symposiums, they were amazing. They were so much better than anything that's out these days. How did they come to be, and why did they go away?
Well, right. Okay. 2 questions there. The first thing I had, what happened was, I've been to a number of conventions, big conventions, usually, admittedly. And being lovers of close up, Chris and I would sit looking and watching magic, close up magic, in very poor conditions. Can't see, can't hear, you know. And we were talking about it, and we said, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a convention where everybody, not just the people in the front 2 rows, could actually see? Because in those days, because we did the first one in 1989, so in those days, video wasn't being used as a standard thing at all. I mean, Bob Hamilton was around, and in fact, Bob Hamilton did do a certain amount of video for us at the symposiums. But it was very, very much a case of that close-up was shoved in a corner somewhere, not always under ideal conditions. And so we thought, wouldn't it be great if you could make close-up important by giving it a more theatrical look, having music, lighting, having the performers mic'd up, having steeply tiered lecture theatre type conditions so that people could look down on the table and everybody, even those at the back, would be able to see. And at the time, nobody was doing that, certainly not in the UK. The nearest thing, I suppose, although I didn't know about it at the time, would have been 4Fs in the States, which I've been to many times now, but I didn't know about it at that stage. So we said, well, okay, can we do it? And do we want to do it? I said, well, I definitely want to do it, I said. I definitely want to do it, but I'll only do it, Chris, if you'll help me, because I can't do this on my own. So he agreed, bless him, to help me. And we tried to book, and we did book some top names. Sometimes we book people who went on to become household names, Guy Hollingworth, Richard Wiseman, people like that, who weren't big names at the time, but have since become world renowned. And there were lots of that, as well as we had people like, as you say, Tommy Wonder, John Bannon, people of that ilk, who were fantastic. And it was, for us, was exciting because we got to, in Bath University that we used, we got to see close up of the top people done in under good conditions. We managed to make it more theatrical with the lighting and the sound, all the rest of it. And it was an event. And it was very successful. You know, I think it was capped at about 100 tickets. Anyway, we did it every other year because to do one every year, with all my other commitments, I said to Chris, I can't do that. And he didn't want to do it every year either. He was a doctor. He was very busy. So I said, let's do it every 2 years. It felt like we did it every year, Craig, to be honest, because we'd go back into Bath University. And it can't be 2 years since it really is 2 years since we were here last. And I had one or two other people. It was a small team. Chris's brother, Mark, he also helped us. He did all the stuff in the sound booth. And my other friends, another one of my friends, Stuart Barry, was on the spotlight. So we were a small team on the day. We'd all come together and do it. And we had the same team every single time. So we all knew what we were doing come the end. But unfortunately, just before we did what turned out to be the last one, the session arrived, the new kid on the block in Gloucester. And we had our convention, I think it was in April, and the first session, I think, was in March or something like that. And it was in the same area, geographical area, and it was hyped very well. And it took away from our, we still had our regulars, but it undermined, and they were doing it every year. And it undermined our base of people. And it made us, because by this time it was 2005. So because it was every other year, starting 89, 2005, sounds like a lot of conventions, but it's only, I say, nine. And we thought, you know what? I don't think we can compete with this. The format is starting to feel old fashioned. And the session was trendy, very trendy when it started. I mean, I love Vanishing Ink's version in London now. I go, you know, it's great. But in the early days, it was much more intimate, wasn't it? And
when they had it in the Gloucester area, it was a lot.
That's right. That's right. So we decided to cut our losses before we failed. I said to Chris, I think maybe I'll do other things. And as you know, over the years, I've come up with a number of different events that weren't clones of that. They were literally completely different concepts. But I loved the symposia. I did. And then we had some people who came to all of them. And the strange thing was that the slight disappointment was that we got virtually no support from local magicians at all. In other words, Bristol and Bath magicians didn't come. Hardly any of them. I had people coming from abroad. This was a mad thing. They get on a plane, but somebody who lives 10 minutes down the road couldn't be bothered going. He's like, I come to the convention, which was always a bit of a surprise. So you never profit in your own backyard.
That's crazy. But, yeah. And is the symposium book still available?
Yes. There was the hardback book you're talking about was the first decade. That's so crazy. It was six conventions. Then we did three more. And as you know, each convention had a book with the material from the performers in it. And so I do a sort of symposium collection as an ebook collection, which has the material from the big book plus the extra three versions, 7, 8, and 9, convention 7, 8, and 9. That's all in sort of one big ebook. So yes, it is.
That's amazing. Well, people should go and buy that. I'll put a link down below. So outside of that, I want to talk about a couple of other things as well. And one of the things I want to talk about is the fact that you did a 4-DVD set for L&L. And you were one of the last acts that did an L&L DVD set, I believe. And for me, I miss those days. You know, I review magic and it's all single tricks and like, oh, you're going to end 10-minute tutorials. I used to love it when an L&L DVD, I was like, I would just lock myself away for just weeks, just watching it again and again. And, you know, it felt like somebody was putting their entire act out in front and saying, learn this. And it was amazing. And I do miss them. But yours especially was wonderful because You did a three DVD set, but then you did your master routines as a fourth DVD set, which I've always been a big fan of. How did the LNL thing come to be? Did you know at the time when you went there that LNL were slowly starting to wind down, or
No, I didn't. Lewis contacted me and invited me to go over. And at the time, and that would have been, I think that was about 2005, 2006, something like that. And of course, I had a lot of material that to choose from by that stage. So he said, wow, he said, you've got so much here. I think we need to make, you know, the, as you say, the master routines as a separate thing, because it was a complete package in itself. He said, but all this other material, we'll do, we decide to divide it into money magic, envelope magic, and sort of general magic, and put about 10 or a dozen things on each DVD. And I have to say that it was one of the most enjoyable work sessions I've ever had. I know people used to got tired of the LNL enthusiastic audiences because they seem over the top when you're watching it in your front room on your own. But when you're there, I just loved it. They give you so much energy because they're not all lay people, of course. A lot of the locals, he had a, you know, a mailing list, and he sends out to the mailing list, I'm doing another one of these. If you want to come along, let me know. And he gives them meals and they come in and they watch all the magic. Then local magicians obviously go as well. So there was a few magicians in the audience that I was there doing for. And it was just fantastic. It's extremely hard work. It was a very long day. That's why I look so shattered. I did all the master routines. That's 12 long routines. Then I did another 30 to 40 individual tricks all in the same day. And then I did the explanations for all the master routines. So we started at 9 in the morning. Obviously, there were breaks during the day. We started at 9 in the morning and finished at about 8 o'clock at night and then did the rest the next day. So it was all done in 2 days. And when I look at myself, I'm sort of pale as anything, jet lagged. I'd only flown in like 2 days previously. And I looked like death warmed up, I think. But I was very pleased the way it came out. And actually, very grateful to Lewis, because at the time, he gave me personally a huge boost in terms of exposure. Because as a little individual dealer, people in America and around the world, a lot of them never heard of me. But they knew, obviously, of all the people at LNL. And he said, oh, who's this guy, you know? And the number of people who say, oh, I've got your LNL DVDs, especially in the States. Unbelievable. When I go and lecture over there, oh, yeah, I've got that, and I've got this, and I've got that. I didn't know who these people were because I wasn't aware, because it all went through LNL. So I was, thrilled to be asked and loved doing it, and very, very pleased with the way it all came out in the end. And I would have felt disappointed to have missed the boat. I don't know how long they went. I think you're right. I don't think they went on making. They started to do compilations, and so they had new releases, but they were all compilations and things like that. So yes, I was probably one of the last.
You were, and you're the DVDs are still available as downloads and DVDs. People should get them because they are phenomenal. I mean, they are really, really good. Genuinely amazing. Now, on top of all of this, I mean, I'm just listening to you talking and thinking about how busy you are. You're traveling around the world lecturing. You're running events. You're busy performing. You're a family man. You're creating magic. You're running Mark Leverage Magic. Everything is super successful. You must be the busiest person in magic. You're learning more about business. And you know, we've spoken about the entrepreneur circle. And then you decide to go and set up what is effectively another business by setting up Magic Scene. weren't you busy enough, Mark? I mean, how did that, I'm doing all of this. I'm here. I know, let's go set up another business, which has now become ridiculously successful as well. Like, what made you decide to do that? How did that
come? To be fair, the idea wasn't mine. I was very, very lucky in that. And again, this was mid-2000s. A lot of things happened at that time. I was... the phone rang one day and somebody called Graham Hay was on the other end. He said, "You don't know me. I know you," he said, "but I'm a magician. And my mate, Phil Shaw, and I, we do magazines." And he said, we're both magicians, and we think there's a gap in the marketplace for a quality full color, because magazines weren't full color at that time, full color magic magazine in the UK. And we are looking, you see, they'd done magazines for, Phil does the design, Graham does a lot of the content. They did like the England cricket team's magazine, for, so they're not magic related at all, lots of magazines. Graham worked provided cartoons and things for daily newspapers and things like that. And they said, "But we need somebody who is well known in the magic world and who would front, if you like, be the name that people would identify with and would hopefully be a good selling point. And we thought of you." So I thought, "Well, that's very kind of you." And I remember thinking at the time, this is a scam, you know? And I remember thinking, next thing they're going to say, "Now, the setup cost is £5,000. We're each putting £5,000. So if you'd like to send us a check or whatever, or transfer us £5,000, and then they disappear over the..." But that wasn't the case. And so I was a little bit cool to begin with, I must admit, looking back. I was a bit... Because for a start, I hadn't expected anything like this, so I wasn't prepared. You know, somebody comes up, "We want you to be the editor and have a lot of say in the content and do some writing and promote it." And I think, oh, crikey. And at the time, my wife and I, we owned a school and we were running a school. It was an independent school.
Of course we were.
And we did it for 20 years. And although I was qualified as a teacher, I wasn't doing any teaching. I was doing the marketing. I was dealing with, because it was a fee-paying school, with the parents and all that side of it. And then this opportunity came along. And like you've just said, I went, "Oh, crikey, I'm stretched as it is. Can I take this on?" So I said to them, "Well, how often is this magazine going to..." "I can't be doing a monthly." "Oh, no, it's going to be six times a year, a bi-monthly." Okay. Anyway, so I met them. And we got on really well. I met them. I was doing down at one of the IBM conventions at the time, and we met there, Southport or wherever it was. And we had a long discussion, and I haven't laughed so much in a long time. They're very funny, Graham in particular, but Phil too. They're great guys. They're so funny. And I really like them, and we got on well. So we thrashed out what it would look like. And then in 2005, in March, we brought out the first issue. And I remember that we released it at Blackpool, and we printed an extra 3,000 copies and gave one to everybody who came to the convention to give ourselves a kickstart. And it has been extremely successful. I mean, we're still around despite everything, and publishing magazines in any field these days is difficult. So many have gone to the wall. But we're still here. We're still enjoying it. It's quite a lot of work, but it's enjoyable. I love the writing. I've always liked writing, and to be given the opportunity to write about magic, and then it's amazing, Craig. You know, you get all this stuff, and you write it all down, and send it to Phil, and Phil does this magic on it, and returns this beautiful looking. And you think, "Oh wow, this is awesome!" It's like a drug. You keep wanting. "Oh, I'm going to send him some more texts, and he'll send me back some more beautiful looking stuff." So, in fact, on the strength of the magazine, and as you say, I was doing Mark Levish magic and everything else. We actually shut the school in the end because we just we couldn't cope with everything. It was just too much. And the magazine came along at the tail end of that. So that was why I had the time to do it. But yeah, it's another string to my bow. It's a separate, completely separate business. And the one problem that I foresaw I've managed to avoid was, I said to Graham and Phil, I don't want people to think that this is a Mark Levish magic magazine. It's an independent magazine. I have no personal influence. I have an advert in it, but it's not a vehicle for me.
Yeah.
It's an independent. And I said, I think that's really important that people understand that. So that's why at Blackpool, when I still had my dealer stand, my stand was completely separate from Magic Scenes. We were next to each other as it happened, but we were completely separate because I didn't want people to think that. And it is a separate business, even though I'm heavily involved with it.
And let me ask, there's going to be magicians that are watching this that see, because you publish so many magazines now, and there's always somebody wonderful on the front cover. What does somebody have to do to be get featured in Magic Scene? How do they get on your radar as the editor?
Well, there are a number of different ways. Pay me a huge amount of money. No, that's not true. Usually we try to pick somebody who we think our readers will want to see. Somebody who has either a very high profile already, or somebody who is quirky, different, or who we think is going to have a high profile at some point and deserves a push. We're looking for people who offer something a little bit different, or who are just simply notorious or famous, or there's no one criteria, I suppose, is or criterion. There's no as such. And actually, I don't deal with my side of it is writing the articles to do with advice, how to, okay, that type of thing. Graham is the one who does all of the features. And I, even though I'm the editor and do all the proofreading and everything else, I don't know in advance which celebrities are going to be in and who's going to be on cover until I proofread it. And I get the PDFs that come through. Oh, well, that's who's on cover. I don't always know because Graham deals with all that. And it's quite good in that way because, again, that's enabling me to stand back slightly from that process, not with a vested interest, not my favourite people necessarily. They might be, but it's not. That's not why they're on the cover. And as editor, it gives me a certain dispassionate way of looking at the whole magazine. I suppose that's the answer. There is no one answer.
And off the back of that, just briefly mentioning this before we move on, Magic Scene has evolved, and now as a company, they've published some amazing books over the years as well. Was that something that was the plan from the beginning, or did that just become a natural progression of having a publishing company that you could then move in that direction?
Bit of both. I don't remember us discussing that at our early meetings. That was all about the magazine, and we had to get that established, which isn't easy. I remember when we launched at Blackpool in 2005, a very well-known, at the time, very well-known magician came up to look at it. And he said, "Oh yes, another magazine, is it?" Like that. I said, yes, it is. We're very excited about it. Well, I shan't be subscribing. Oh, okay. That's fair enough. Why not? Well, it won't last. Ah, thanks. Well, with that ringing endorsement, let's get to work. So if ever I need motivating to keep it going, it was what he said, it won't last. So here we are in 2022, you know, 18th, 19th year, whatever it is. So, I forgot one of the old books. So, but we realized that a bit like with Goodliffe Publications, with ABRA, they needed to supplement the income from, and to keep the magazine going, you need to have books. Mm. They felt they needed to have books. And to a certain extent, it's the same with us. Partly is to do with the fact that we have got the facility, you know, the three of us in particular have the skill sets required to produce books. But also it is an added addition to our income and helps us to, at times, sponsor the magazine to keep things going. And COVID was extremely challenging because nobody wanted to spend any money on anything, especially when it first came. As you'll know, Craig, it was shows dried up instantly. Everybody was really, really worried. They didn't know how it was going to end or when it was going to end. And so we took the unprecedented step, because I said to the guys, the advertisers are pulling out because they don't want to advertise because nobody's buying. So in the end, we decided we would go digital. and do just digital. We always had a digital version, but we decided to go digital for three issues. In the end, it turned out to be three issues. So it's for 6 months in order to make it cheaper to produce so that we didn't have to worry about that so much. And then we extended all the printed people's subscriptions were extended by three issues. So nobody lost out, but it just enabled us to tread water. So it's things like that that kept us afloat. Otherwise, it would have been tricky. But the books are definitely an income stream, which is important. And we really appreciate when people buy the books, because not only is it a great showcase for the people whose books we do, but obviously it's helping to keep Magic Scene alive and kicking and continuing to produce a bi-monthly magazine.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. Moving away from Magic Scene, I want to bring something else up as well. You talked about going digital for a little while with Magic Scene. And I mentioned earlier on that you always seem to have this ability to predict trends and be one of the first people to move in that direction. Before COVID, way before COVID, you made the decision to take Mark Leverage Magic and bring it online only, which was a huge thing because I knew you for your wonderful inventive props and you're always producing physical. It was always a physical product and it was never an online thing. But then all of a sudden, one day you made the announcement, hey, you know, at this point on this date, there's going to be no more physical products. I suppose, again, two questions. One, what made you decide to go down that route, which probably, you know, looking at it now is the right call, but I don't know if anybody else had made that decision at that point. And two, were you worried? Because it's like you relied on physical products for Mark Leverage Magic to exist and to make that leap to go, well, I'm not going to do that anymore, especially when it happened. It wasn't like now, you know, we're connected with Zoom and it's a natural. But back when you made that decision, that wasn't the case. And, you know, were you a little bit worried as to you were making the right decision? Where did that all come about?
It was April 2017, you're right, when I went completely digital. And I trailered it, if you like, for several months beforehand, saying, if you want to get these physical products, you need to buy them now because I'm going to go completely digital. So in that sense, it shouldn't have been a surprise to my regular customers. A disappointment to some, I know, because it meant I had to discontinue. You mentioned Perfect Crime earlier on. That's a classic example of it's a prop. You can't make it yourself. So unfortunately, you know, things like that were discontinued. However, the whole process started before that. It started back in 2011 when I was starting to feel that I was becoming surplus to requirements in the magic world. I felt that my customer base was growing old with me. That's fine, but that I wasn't pulling in enough younger people and that they probably saw me as a bit of a dinosaur. And I didn't like that thought. As you say, I've always tried to keep slightly ahead of the curve. And I remember thinking to myself, do you know, some of these big dealers, that I can't compete with these guys. The marketing that they're doing is and it's even, I say worse, even better now in the sense that it's so sophisticated, technical, clever, Hollywood trailer style, you know, Dems. And I thought, I'm not sure I can compete with this. If I'm not just to fizzle out, I feel like I've still got a lot to contribute. But the people who are going to be interested in what I have is probably going to be a lot less. And I asked myself the question, how do you feel about that, Mark? And I chewed over it for ages. And I thought, you know what? I feel like I've got, if I'm looking for something that I can offer that is slightly different to anybody else, it would be the fact that I am older. I'm not totally ancient, but I am older. So, and I have a lot of experience. I've done a lot of things. And I used to, at the time, I often get people emailing me, how do you approach a table? What's your technique for this? What's your technique for that? And I would studiously sit there, me be me, and type them a great long screen reply as to how I do it. And I thought, you know what, why don't I set up an online sort of club where all this information could be drip fed to people who want to know it. In other words, why don't I create something where the people who are interested in what I have to say and who like the way that I think can gravitate and come and be cozy with me, and the people who don't, they can ignore me and then I won't mind. And that's why eClub Pro started. So in January 2011, I set up this online club, which is still going. And it's been very successful. It's created, it's got over 900, nearly 1,000 pages of content. Most of it is video. I add to it every single month. It's given me all my energies increasingly in creative terms were channeled into eClub Pro for the members. So members pay a monthly payment and they get access to this information. Now at the time, there was hardly anybody doing that. I've noticed in recent times, more and more people are getting onto this as an idea. Not copying me, I don't mean. I just mean the concept of having a subscription-based online presence. And although Jay Sankey was doing it at the time, I think it's hardly anybody else was doing it. So I liked the idea of this. I was very excited about this. But what it meant was that because my thoughts and energies were every month were channeled at eClub Pro, it gave me less time and less incentive to bring out tricks in the normal way I had been. And I was attending conventions and being bypassed. People were going to the Vanishing Inks of this world, who were the new kids on the block at that time and who were exciting and had a big range and had famous people behind the stand. And I felt myself being marginalized. And I was getting quite upset about it. And Chris Payne, who is still a close friend, and we've mentioned him already, he used to come with me to Blackpool. And I did a couple of Blackpools. I was actually quite, not clinically depressed, but just fed up. I said, you know, I'm so fed up. I've stood there for 3 days. I will den to anybody. I can't get people to stop. They're cutting me off in the corner. They're going round. And I was really getting fed up. I said, oh, I'm fed up with this. I don't want to do this anymore. And then, so Chris and I discussed it. And I said, do you know what I'm thinking of doing? I reckon. He said to me, how many of your tricks could you sell online? Just because he said, most of you, what you sell are actually ideas. Yes, you've got some props, but a lot of your tricks, you supply a pack of cards with a simple gimmick. Anybody could make it. It's the idea. It's that you've got a lot, probably about 60, 70% of your stuff. It's idea-based. It'd be perfect for my life. Ah, that's true. So having thought that, had that thought, I then started to think, I was very, very nervous, really, really nervous about doing this. I thought this could finish me off. This could be, I may look back and go, well, that was a stupid idea. But I did want to do it because I thought, I can't carry on like this. I'm not enjoying it anymore. What's the point? I can't compete at this level, so let's change the level. Let's do something completely different. And eClub Pro has carried on. I love doing eClub Pro. I love the video, making the videos, putting the podcasts and all the other stuff that I do. And as you say, you know, with Zoom and various other things, people are much more screen orientated anyway. So it just so happens, I think more by luck than judgment, that I did it at the right time. Yeah. And then in terms of the selling Mark Levy's magic products, with them all being downloads, I don't have to put so much physical input into processing orders. It's all automated, which means that it gives me more time to concentrate on eClub Pro and, to be quite honest with you, more time to live my life and enjoy my grandchildren, which was another reason why I wanted to create more time rather than work the whole time.
That's amazing. And it has worked really, really well for you. And I'm going to put a link down below because I want people to check out eClub Pro. That's amazing. So that kind of brings us up to date to where we are now. You've as a performer and as a magic dealer, and you know, in terms of the magazine, you've survived COVID, which is amazing because I've seen so many that haven't, and now obviously we've hopefully moved past, and you know, kind of things are opening up again now, which is wonderful. My question to you is, what's next? Because like I said to you at the very beginning, you've always come across to me as very entrepreneurial, and you've always come across to me as somebody who's looking for new opportunities and new ideas, taking things in a different direction. I didn't even know you had a school. So crazy. That's just madness on top of everything you were doing. Yeah. So I suppose the question is, you know, your legacy is set, Mark. It genuinely is. If you decided today to shut down everything that you do, people will be performing your routines and talking about you for a very, 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 very long time. You've done so much in this community and you've given so much back. But I know that you're not going anywhere. You just said at the beginning of this interview, you're going to carry on performing as long as you can. So what's next? Is there anything left on your magical bucket list that you haven't achieved? Is there anything left that you're wanting to do? What are your goals? Because I know being an entrepreneur, you're going to have goals. What are your goals moving forward over the coming weeks, months and years?
Well, despite what you might imagine, I'm not a blue sky thinker. I am hopeless. You ask my wife. She's a blue sky thinker. I'm a details person. And when she and I have done a lot of projects together, apart from being married to her, we've done a lot of projects together, school being one of them. And she came to me one day and she said, I want to buy my own school. What? Yeah, I'm bored with my job. And I've always fancied having a little school of my own, a primary school. Can we get one? And I've heard of one that's for sale. Right. I said, how the hell are we going to afford a school? Oh, I don't know. You sort that out. I just want to have a school. Now, what I'm going to do with this school is, and she then went into this blue sky thinking thing, this concept of what it was going to be like and how we were going to run it. And I'm sitting there and all I'm thinking about is, where the heck am I going to get thousands and thousands of pounds to invest in a building and a school and all the rest of it? Anyway, I did it. We managed it. And it wasn't easy, but we did it. Much to the surprise of all our close friends who said, how did you do that? I said, that's my secret. I'm never going to reveal how I did it. It's magic. It was magic. So I'm not one who sets long-term goals. So I don't have a bucket list. I've never had one. And I tend to respond to how I feel at any given moment. You know, getting rid of all of the physical products was not a plan I'd actually started back in 2011. It was simply that I'd seen how successful online stuff could be. So by the time I actually decided, do you know what? I'm fed up with this. I want to change. That's the moment when I started to think, actually, seeing how well eClub Pro's done, then this might work, rather than me having some great strategic plan. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, that's not a very good answer to your question. I'm likely to do all the time that I'm able to offer something. I've always said that I really worry slightly about people going, oh, poor old chap. You know, he used to be good. Look, he can't do it anymore. And that has always been a fear of mine, that I kind of hope that my close friends will say, you want to think about whether you want to do this still? Because I think we're all not very self-aware sometimes. So I will continue to do what I do at the moment as best I can for as long as I can. And have realized the older you get, the more time becomes precious. And what you do with that time is more important to you. And it's not always jobs, you know, family and you know, with your family, Craig, they become increasingly important, don't they? So a totally unsatisfactory and non-inspirational answer to your final question, but that's the truth.
That's fine. Well, you know, I'm sure that you're going to be doing something else. It'll just, a thought will hit you. And
no doubt.
You know, I see it all of the time. You just off camera before we started, I remember you doing those. It was kind of like almost a dealer dem evening sort of thing. And it was genius. I remember looking at it at the time, and I went to one, if you remember. And I was like, I was like, this is just a genius idea. It's like no one else is doing this. And you're setting up this captive audience where it's a lecture, but they're going to be buying your stuff and you're giving them a discount. See you do something, I'm like, that's okay. So I just expect things like this to come out of you, because I just see it over and over again that there's always something really, really clever that pops up and it's got your name attached to it.
Those were you came to the one in Birmingham, didn't you? That was dealer night. They were called dealer nights, and I did it at the time because we were in recession, and I thought magicians want, they've got a little bit of money to spend, but they haven't got a lot, so they're looking for bargains. So I had the idea of offering, I said, well, it's £10 to come, but you get a voucher for £10, which I don't think at that time anybody was doing. It's been done since, and I still use the same model for on my, I do a lot of online Zoom, inner circle Zoom sessions I do, and also my lectures on online via Zoom. And I do the similar thing. I offer people, the reason I make a charge is because I think if you pay for something, you tend to value it more than if it's free. So if you've made some sort of financial commitment, even if it's not a huge amount of money, 10 or 20 pounds or something, you're more likely to think, no, I pay for that, I'm going to go and do it. But at the same time, I like to think that I can give something back to, as a way of me saying thank you, to say, look, I'll tell you what, you pay £20 to come to this event, but I'll give you something that's worth £20 or a voucher or whatever it is to spend again. So effectively, if you use your voucher, you're getting the event for free. And I kind of like that model. I think it's a quite an attractive model for people to consider when they're deciding what they want to do with their money.
Oh, it really is. You know, it's just genius, 100%. Now, we've got to the end of the interview. Where can people check you out? I mean, first of all, I'm going to be putting everything up at the bottom of the screen and also in the description. Your website is markleveragemagic.co.uk.
It's actually markleveragemagic.co.uk, although I also have the URL markleveragemagic.co.uk. I own that one too, just in case.
Okay, so markleveragemagic.co.uk. Yep. That's where people go to check out everything. And it's your website is a real hub. Like, you've got your podcast on there, which gets published monthly, which is free for anybody to listen to. You've got obviously new tricks that you're putting up there all of the time, which people can buy, but you get a discount if you're in the e-club. You've got various different memberships. There's a lot on there. A lot of the past stuff that you've done is on there, and also new things get bought out all of the time.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. When I changed the website about 3 years ago, in order to make it more eClub Pro centric, because the old website I had needed to be changed anyway. I'd had it for about 10 years, but I wanted the new website to be a hub for eClub Pro, not to be nothing else, but that's the core. Because on the homepage, there's a lot of information about eClub Pro and being a member, because that's how you get the best value. That's where you get access. And there are couple of levels. There's an elite level and a pro level. The pro level is the standard level, and the elite, you get even more access to me, personal access to me, and a lot of extra detailed content, particularly on marketing and things like that. So, and then the rest of the website, as you say, it's got the podcast and my blog and loads of, and obviously tricks that are nothing to do with eClub Pro, which you can buy. Although, as you say, if you're a member of eClub Pro, then you get a 50% discount on everything. So, you know, it's you can easily save the monthly membership fee if you just buy the occasional trick, quite frankly.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And if people want to, obviously, and I'm not just saying this, I genuinely mean it. You know, I've got a reputation for saying what I think. You're an amazing lecturer, you're an absolutely incredible lecturer. You are available to book for lectures both over Zoom and in person. Is that right?
Yes, yes. There's a lectures page on the website, gives the details there. And I've done lectures every year since 1977. I've lectured every year, often many times in each year, but sometimes just less than others, just depending on whether there's a new lecture out. But Zoom has been great, but I love doing the Zoom version. I think my material works very well over Zoom. I think some types of lecturer may struggle a little bit, but I think for my close-up in particular, close-up and stand-up stuff, Zoom is a really good way for everybody to have a front seat. And I think from the lecturer's point of view, not having to do the traveling and how tiring that can be, driving, you know, hundreds of miles and then having to present a lecture the same evening is not always the most attractive option. However, I'm very happy to if people would like me to come and attend in the club room, happy to do that too. Obviously, it's a lot cheaper to have me do the Zoom version than it is to have me attend personally, but happy to do either.
Amazing. Final question. And this is really important. So one of my 1,000 timers, as Greg Wilson would call it, one of my 1,000 timers that I do everywhere for magicians and laymen is one of your routines. And I performed it on my channel a little while ago. And I had so many people say, and I credited you and I said, this is Mark's routine, blah, 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 blah. And I've had so many people say, where can I get it from? And I directed them through to your website and they've come back to me and said they can't find it. So I need to know if it's ever going to be released as an e-version or if it is where you can get it from. Now, I think the name, because I bought it so many years ago, I've got like five of them. Brainstormer, the blank deck. Is it Brainstormer? Please tell me.
Yes, Brainstormer.
It's the greatest card trick of all time, as far as I'm concerned. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. And I just do it every opportunity I can get. Is that available? I know that it came with a gaff deck, but you could teach people how to make it.
I've had a couple of versions of Brainstormer. I don't know when you bought yours. If you bought it relatively early on, I think it came out in the mid 80s or something. It was the biggest selling card trick I'd ever had. I can remember taking it to a convention, and for the first time ever, I took a lot and I sold the whole lot. Wow. I sold the last one about 2 minutes before the dealers closed. I was so happy. I could genuinely say it just sold out. I said to Chris Payne, who was helping me at the time, I said, if I don't sell this one, you're going to have to buy it, because I don't want to say it was a sellout when it wasn't. So subsequently, I came up with a different method. It's a slightly different handling. I personally prefer it, that this handling. This is available. Yes, I do sell it as a digital version, video download. It's not difficult to put together. You'd have to get the cards.
Yeah.
But having said all that, if people are prepared to wait a little while, Liam Montier at Kmart has bought the rights to Brainstormer, and he's going to be releasing it. So, and this will be the sort of newer version.
Mm, okay.
So I don't know when it's going to be out, but he relatively recently. The rights.
So they can still get it as a digital download from you.
It's always been there as a digital. And funnily enough, I sold three of them today.
Oh, wow.
Literally today. I have no idea why. Somebody has mentioned it somewhere. And it's kind of ironic because unless it's something to do with you, I don't know. But
it might be, because I do magic lives every day and I perform various different routines. And it was a couple of weeks ago that I performed Brainstormer. And
maybe it's something to do with that then. It was three different countries purchasers lived in. I couldn't understand it. I mean, I was delighted, of course, but I couldn't understand it because I thought, I haven't mentioned Brainstormer for a while. Somebody out there must have done it or said something about it, or you know. But
I did that, and then about a week before that I did the virus card, which is another amazing trick.
Well, that's another one that Liam's got. He loves virus card. And it was one of the first tricks he bought off me when he was a youngster. And he said, could he buy the rights? And he has. He's released that last year, I think. So you can get that one complete from him as well.
It's a great trick. And it was perfect for my virtual shows during COVID.
Yeah, I bet it was.
It was brilliant. It was a great way, actually, if I was performing to kids, to explain about COVID using that deck. It was like it was written for this whole situation we're in.
Yeah, it's funny that.
Yeah, so good. Okay, awesome. So either directly from you, or we wait a undetermined amount of time and eventually it'll be a physical product from
you. Yeah.
Amazing. Mark, this has been an incredible interview. I told you beforehand, I was so excited about doing this interview. I'm so glad I've had you on the channel. You are a legend, and I genuinely mean that. And you've been a big inspiration on my career. I know you've been a big inspiration to magicians all over the world as well. And, you know, on behalf of the magic community, thank you for everything that you've done for the last 30 odd years and you continue to do. And, you know, I want everyone who's listening to this to go and support you. The link's down below. Whatever you pick up from Mark is going to be super practical, commercial, and just really well thought out. So, Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig. Appreciate the opportunity. It's been lovely to chat to you. We haven't had I know it's not a personal chat, but we haven't had a chat for a long time. So it's been lovely. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Guys, I want you to do me a favor. Leave a comment down below so that Mark can see it. And don't forget, get onto Mark's mailing list as well. I'm on his mailing list and it's free to get on his mailing list. And he emails you lots of links to podcasts and articles and really insightful stuff. It's not just a mailing list where you go and, you know, it's just buy, buy, buy. There's a lot more value to it than that. So even if you don't buy anything immediately, go on the website, subscribe to the mailing list. It's the best thing that you can do. And I will be back tomorrow with another video. But one more time, Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're done. How was that?
Well done. That was lovely. That was so nice. I almost forgot I had COVID for a minute.
Well, you couldn't tell at all.
Good. I thought it might bring me out of myself if I, you know, having a chat with you. So I like the way you do that, actually, because you obviously know what you're talking about because of what you asked. But it didn't feel all scripted and artificial. You make it so natural. You're a lovely interviewer. Well done. You obviously got experience of doing it, but it's lovely to be the person on the other end of you, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
No, I appreciate that, Mark. I really do. And it was easy doing it with you because I know a lot about your career and I know a lot about what you've done. So I didn't know about the school. I mean, wow, that threw me for six.
I know. It was a funny thing, really, because it wasn't something that I broadcast at the time because, you know, it was just another area of our lives. And but it was a bit stressy because having an independent school, fee-paying school, the maximum number of pupils we could take was 60. So it was only small. And the old address, if you look on my old instruction sheets, 13A Lyndhurst Road, that was the school. Mm-hmm. And we lived upstairs. It was a Victorian house. And we lived upstairs. And the school was downstairs. And it was set up after the Second World War by a lady who, I suppose the government perhaps was trying, because of so much bomb damage and various other things, they were trying to get people to educate kids. And we bought it from the previous owners who'd been there for 20 years. But eventually it got to the point it wasn't tenable because the new regulations for, you know, excuse me, are not just educational things that you have to comply with, but also with physical things, health and safety, employment law. We employed 12 people, nightmare, absolute nightmare. And in the end, do you know what? We're getting so stressed with this. It's not worth it. Let's call it a day, close it down. And then we converted the building completely back to a house.
Oh, wow.
And then we moved from there in 2017 as well. September 2017, we moved to where we are now. So, yeah.
Wow. That's mad.
It is mad.
It is crazy how you managed to do that along with everything else. I've got no idea.
Do you think sometimes that I was thinking about this because when I knew you were going to ask me various questions, I thought, well, I don't exactly know what you're going to ask me, but presumably it's going to be the various things I've done. And I was thinking back over the various things that I've done, kind of trying to refresh my own mind what it was. Because as I said to you, I'm a rubbish blue sky thinker. You know, long-term plans and I'm useless at it. I don't have that sort of capacity. And what I realized was all the things that I've done, and you mentioned lots of them, came about almost not by accident exactly, but almost at the last minute. Oh, I fancy doing science, so let's do that then. And it's only when you look at the entirety, like you've just done, and said, look, in this 40 years, you've done this. And you think, how the hell have I done all that? When did I do all that? I don't remember all that. Because at the time, you do it bit by bit, don't you? And it's only when you look back on your career and you say, good grief, that's an awful lot of things. I don't remember. Because it gets kind of, I often think that if you read, I don't know, it should be morbid, but you read obituaries, you know, of famous people or something, and their life is crystallized down into a few paragraphs. And you think all the things they've done in their life, and that's what it boils down to. It has that feeling to it. It all gets truncated.
Yeah.
And interesting, though. Interesting process.
Yeah, well, you have done so much. I mean, just take a small section of what you've done. If you said to a magician, you could do this, by the time your career is finished, you could just do this. They'd be like, I'll take that. And you've done that. Plus a million other things. And your career's not over. I mean, it's genuinely inspirational. It really is.
Oh, thanks. Well, so I think I'm going to go and lie down in a darkened room now.
I think you need to. I think you need to.
But you.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast. Magic. Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel. Magic TV. Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.